dishes in the world were first made and cooked in this country. Iranian dishes have original and natural tastes. We use spices as much as necessary in food. Each culinary school has prominent aroma and flavor that is introduced with it. The fragrance of Iranian cuisine is made of saffron, cardamom, and rose water and a golden color. Iranian food has a mild taste. In cooking, we pay attention to the benefits and what is harmful in the ingredients. Everything must be in balance. Shah, pure animal oil, ambarbu, tarimi and hashimi rice, lamb of Mughan, afshar and sangsari, Azerbaijan yogurt, desful citrus, dates of bam and bushir, Khorasan wheat, and north and south fish each have a special and unique taste. This documentary is a tribute to thousands of years of Iranian cooking. This work is about Iranian food. It is about people we don't know but who are involved in our sustenance. This documentary is a tribute to the mothers of this land who taught their children the cooking traditions of Iran generation after generation so that this old and unique art remains eternal. This documentary is a tribute to our beloved country, Iran. Iran is a country full of wealth in so many ways, tens of generations before us, and we use the same Iranian dishes, and it is up to us to protect the sacred heritage. I'm Nusha Tabibi Gilani. I'm interested in Iranian culture and food. After the invasion of Mahmud Hotak and the destruction of the Safavi dynasty, a turbulent period was imposed on Iran. The conflicts and rise of Nader Shah and the overthrow of Shah Tahmasib II and the rule of Karim Khan Zand brought short periods of balance and peace that were not very stable. In these periods, naturally, decorative arts and the construction of buildings and emirates were not considered and did not have a chance to grow. Agha Muhammad Khan, the ruler of the Qajar dynasty, established a new era for Iran by unifying the country and establishing regulations, stability, and security. In this period, the construction of buildings, state emirates, and decorative arts started again. Qajari's special aesthetics gradually appeared. There is a mixture of delicate and detailed Safavid art and European-style paintings. The use of new colors and patterns signaled the beginning of another era in Iranian fine arts. Iranians have the same skill in cooking various types of bread as they have a unique skill in cooking different types of ash. Bread and ash are predominant in Iranian cooking and play important roles in our cuisine. Cooking each of these important elements in Iranian sofre needs different skills. Many hidden treasures of the Iranian culture and history can be found in Khorasan.
در اینجایی که ما هستیم گزلدره یک رشته.
Now we are in گزلدره سفلا. We will visit a place where they cut noodles. We will know about the process of making noodles.
خواهیم دید.
Cutting noodles is a very common job in Sultania and گزلدره سفلا. It means that there are several workshops and people eat different types of noodles. Sultania was a center of the Ilkhanids government, and it may be the reason why so many people eat noodles in this area. Eating Chinese food was the Ilkhanids culture and can be the reason for the establishment of so many workshops here. These workshops are still active. Sultania was a city that did not last many years. It suddenly appeared in history by the Ilkhanid kings, and it was destroyed after Muhammad Khodabandi's death. He left many important works in this area, like knife making in Zanjan, cutting noodles, and Dashkasan Temple.
Zanjan va misle shayad hamin reshtebori va albatte ma'bad Dashkasan. مغول‌ها همیشه غذاهای ابتدایی نمی‌خوردن. در واقع بعد از اینکه به چین حمله کردن و موفق شدن.
The Mongols did not eat simple foods. After the Mongols invaded China and succeeded in occupying it, they became familiar with the complex culture of the Chinese cuisines and they liked it. After the Mongols invaded Iran and succeeded in occupying it, they brought the same Chinese culture to Iran. It was from then on that we didn't use the word khalegari for cooking. Many believe that the beginning of eating ash and pilaf started from the time of the Mongols. Morteza Ravandi, the author of the book Social History of Iranians, believes that eating rice has been common in Iran since the 15th century. Here is Dashkasan Temple, and it is a very important place because it is the meeting point of Iranian Chinese or Iranian-Mongolian culture. Arghun Khan decided to construct a temple when he still believed in shamanism. After his death, Ultaje Khatun, his daughter, continued building this temple, but when Oljao II became Shia Muslim, the construction of this temple remained half-finished forever. The important point is that maybe there was a Mithraic temple or a pre-Islamic facility here before the construction of the temple. We could see the signs of such infrastructure here. Why is it so important to us? As I said, it is a meeting point of Iranian-Mongolian culture. Ilkhanate architecture is more of Iranian architecture rather than Mongolian. There are dragon sculptures that are Eastern symbols. Iranian and Mongolian cultures have mutual influence. Still, many Iranian cooking terms are Mongolian, like plate, pilaf, and spoon, among many other names. These are the names that have remained in Iranian culinary culture since the time of the Mongols. And for this reason, I think this temple is a symbol of mutual cultural influence between Iranians and Mongols.
اینجا نماد این فرهنگ تاثیر متقابل فرهنگی بین ما و مغول ها هستش.
Mr. Salimi with his children who are great in martial arts make different and wonderful types of noodles based on the ancient traditions of their ancestors. They work in this workshop in Gozaldare Sofla. They make a smooth dough from a good quality of flour. Sometimes they add turmeric or saffron according to different types of noodles. Sometimes they make smooth dough without using any spice and roast them in the oven. Noodles aren't used only in ash, and sometimes they use it like pilaf and eat it with khoresh. They sometimes mix roasted noodles with pilaf and make reshte polo. Different kinds of delicious noodles are cooked in different ways according to the tastes of the artist chef. The whole process of producing noodles is done in perfect cleanliness. Heyran in the Talish language means the place of cloud and fog. Gardan-e Heyran is located in the west of Gilan province and near the Talish village of the same name on the road to Astara. The humidity that rises from the Caspian Sea reaches this 1,500 meter altitude. For this reason, Gardanehiran and the adjacent valley are always foggy. Gardanehiran, you can eat one of the most famous kinds of ash in the northwest of the country, ashadur. You can also see the beauty of nature here.
طبخ آش‌های لبنی در سراسر ایران رایجه. یعنی آش دوغ، آش ماست، آش قره قروت، آش کش.
Cooking this kind of ash is common through Iran. آش دوغ، آش ماست، آش قره قروت and آش کش are very common in different regions among different ethnic groups and you can find its varieties all over Iran. This kind of ash is popular after آش رشته, that is one of the most common ash and it is cooked differently in various parts of the country. The difference is that some of these types of آش دوغ are flavored with different ingredients. For instance, in Erdebil, they add garlic. In other places, they add mint and fried onions and etc. It has become commonplace that people go to nature and they cook آش there. They would also add mountain plants to flavor the آش. I think it is a great idea to eat آش in Iran's natural sites.
فکر کنم این خیلی فکر خوبیه خوردن آش در دل طبیعت ایران.
Of course, eating ash standing up is not interesting at all. I did this on the instructions of my respected director. We must eat ash together with our friends and relatives and talk about interesting topics. Whenever you eat ash like this, please be kind enough to remember us as well.
آش
شوله یزدی is another type of آش that is cooked in our country. آش شولی is very important in the life of people in Yazd. It is not the main dish, but it is very common, especially when people gather together. It is made of a wonderful combination of vegetables and beetroots. I think it is super delicious and healthy.
فوق‌العاده خوشمزه و به نظرم خیلی سالم هستش.
They eat آش شولی with sugar or vinegar and they like it sweet. Tehran is a city that has been in a struggle between modernity and traditionalism for about two centuries. Like any other modern metropolitan, beauty and ugliness can be seen in this city. Following the procedure of accelerated and alien development, the beauty of the city has been replaced by ugliness. Toubkhane Square's original appearance was changed in a bad way and couldn't be recovered until this day. Tehran became the center of attention since the time of Shah Tahmaseb I. He ordered the construction of fences and buildings in Tehran. Since then, Tehran has gradually attracted the attention of the people of other regions of Iran because it was famous for its wonderful climate and great fruits. Agha Mohammad Khan, head of the Qajar dynasty, chose Tehran as the capital, and after that, the development and expansion of the city was accelerated. The establishment of the royal court and military centers and the development of the Tehran Bazaar as a commercial center of the country in the later periods, especially during the period of Nasir al-Din Shah, elevated the importance of Tehran. And since then, the population of Tehran has been composed of all the people of Iran. Many gates were installed in different parts of the city, of which almost no trace remains today. In the onslaught of modernization of Iran, it was believed that the old buildings and monuments should have been destroyed. Here is the old Toopkhane Square and today's Imam Khomeini Square. They demolished the Baladiya, the city council of Tehran, telegraph office building, and the post office, and built a big and ugly building in their place. The place of the Baladiya remained empty until today, and the alley behind it is a disproportionate relic of its old vision. The Tehran Ray Railway and Telegraph were among the first manifestations of technology in the city. They used Mashin Dudi to go to Ray and pay tribute to Shah Abdul Azim and visit Hazrati Bazar. People liked these moments very much in the old Tehran. Older adults have many memories of this exciting trip. Tehran began to expand irregularly at the end of the Qajar period. In addition, urban management organizations and new facilities were launched in Tehran, but the old way of city administration was still common. In the course of this irregular expansion, cultural and educational facilities, the new commercial and political centers were established in Tehran. Tehran became the center of attention, and this change came with crowdedness and chaos. Traffic and pollution in Tehran became unstoppable phenomena. These problems gradually became a part of the city's identity. More people were able to buy a private car with the increase in oil revenues. Congestion, crowdedness, and density of cars became immeasurable. There are few buildings left from the first period of modern construction. One of these monuments is the Parade Square in Imam Khomeini Street, and the other, Kahe Sharbani, which is currently owned by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. A special architecture is used in such buildings to create a modern space for new offices. A mix of Islamic and ancient Iranian architecture is manifested in this work. The prominent designer of this building is Gabriel Gouvrekian. He is the founder of a new style in modern Iranian architecture. Other buildings of this period, such as the buildings of the Milli Bank, the Civil Registry, and Alborz High School, which were all newly established institutions in that period, followed almost the same architectural style. Today, Tehran suffers from traffic and air pollution. Nowadays, there are more impressive sites to visit in Tehran. Tehran is among the big cities of the world with all of the weaknesses, strengths, the ugliness and beauty of such cities.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
as The holy prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از ایمان.
Self purification is the most significant fact.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRabi English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Nejad. Please stay tuned.
شهید ثانی کتاب داره به نام الفیه.
Shahid Assani, the famous Shiite scholar, has a book titled Alfiya. In that book, he mentions about 1,000 obligatory deeds before establishing Salat. In another book called Nafliya, he mentions 3,000 recommended deeds to be considered when preparing ourselves for Salat. This means that Salat is not merely reciting some formula or bowing down. It is a very significant action. Have we ever enjoyed our Salat during a lifetime, or have we ever had full presence of soul in our Salat? Imam Ridha alayhi salam, in order to show us the greatness of Salat, narrates the story of Qais, the companion of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Once Qais was doing his Salat when a black serpent approached him and crawled over his body and neck. Without an iota of distraction, Qais did his Salat and finished his second rak'ah too. This is how men of Allah do their Salat with full attention. We must at least act like them in our Salat. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRab English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashim Nejad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The latest government statistical data in England show that the price of food has risen sharply. The continuation of this situation has put the focus on food insecurity in Britain. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. Experts have warned slashing the cost of food, fruit and vegetables to ease the cost of living crisis should be on the table at Downing Street's food summit in the coming days. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is facing calls to urge supermarkets to halve what they charge amid stubbornly high inflation rates. Retailers have privately told ministers that food prices have peaked and will start to fall significantly in the coming months. But that will do little to help those battling soaring bills, with warnings even middle-class families are struggling. Farmers, retailers and others from across the UK food chain have been invited to a summit at No. 10 Downing Street. The meeting was reportedly brought forward after food inflation hit another high last month. Professor Tim Lang, a former government advisor, said one message that Prime Minister Rishi Sunak could deliver at the meeting was, he could say, right, I want you to halve the prices on key fruit, vegetable and hydrocarbons like potatoes. The British government's former food czar, Henry Dimbleby, stated that politicians need to be making fruit and vegetable much cheaper for those who can't afford it. Official figures put food and drink price inflation at more than 19.2% in the year to March, almost twice the overall headline inflation rate. The hikes have been given by soaring away energy costs and disruption to the supply chain caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Rising wages, difficult weather conditions which have affected harvests and trade barriers caused by Brexit have all been blamed as factors for rising cost of living. Professor Tim Lang said he was part of a cost of living commission in a London borough which had heard evidence of people going without meals for days. He also warned of what he said was the worsening affordability of even middle-class people to eat a decent diet. The government's former food czar, Henry Dimbleby, stated that he backed a targeted approach, adding, "You need to direct support at the families who are really struggling." Dimbleby warned that it would not be right for the better off to also receive subsidized fruit and vegetables. His recommendations to the government included a community Eat Well program designed to support those on low incomes to improve their diets. Experts warn any changes to the UK supply chain will take time to affect consumers. Prices are already a source of tension between supermarkets and the farmers who produce much of what they see on their shelves. According to reports, the No. 10 Downing Street event will feature speeches and breakout sessions on key themes. There will also be a showcase of Great British food and drink businesses and innovators. A government spokesperson said, "Our UK Farm to Fork Summit will bring together government and representatives from across the food supply chain to step up cooperation and promote all elements of our world-renowned farming and food industries." The government spokesperson added, "The event will look at how we can champion UK food and drink both at home and abroad by boosting confidence, helping more businesses to invest in domestic food production, and supporting the long-term resilience and sustainability of the UK food sector." Bloomberg News Agency has also covered this story and tells us more. According to a report, rising grocery prices in the UK have replaced energy as the main inflationary concern for the Bank of England. Although energy prices have slightly declined, British families are facing a tight squeeze on their finances due to double-digit inflation. Low- and middle-income families are being hit the hardest, given that they spend the bulk of their income on essentials and are now seeing a dramatic increase in their shopping bills. According to the Bank of England, food inflation has been particularly high, reaching 19.1% in March. Over the past year, grocery price growth in the United Kingdom has been at its highest level since records began. According to Bloomberg News Agency, it has now replaced energy costs as the most important financial issue for the public. The Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, told reporters recently, "We're acutely aware of how difficult this rise in food prices is for people, especially for those on lower incomes." Andrew Bailey added, "I expect food price inflation to start slowing down soon, but I admit that it is taking longer than we previously thought." Meanwhile, economists say it has become difficult to argue where prices will go at a time of major supply disruptions caused by the conflict in Ukraine in today's modern interconnected world. According to the Bloomberg News Agency, this has meant that Bank of England lacks past experience for making food price forecasts. The Bank of England's recent monetary policy report said, "The sustained higher price level represents a long-term cost for households and businesses, and this is one driver of subdued economic activity over the forecast horizon." According to Bloomberg, even with lower energy costs, it will take time for food producers such as farmers, who often buy key supplies like fertilizers in advance, to adjust prices and make their goods more affordable to consumers. The British newspaper The Morning Star has also covered this story and tells us more. New research suggests that 1 in 3 young people say their family have relied on food banks or other community outlets for supplies in recent months. The co-op and children's charity Barnardo's said their study of 5,000 individuals between the ages of 10 and 25 found the stark impact the cost of living crisis was having on the access to food and mental well-being of young people and children. The report said almost half of young people have worried about being able to afford things in the past 6 months, with one in three saying their family has used food support, such as a community fridge or a food bank. Almost one in four said they have started the day without a meal. The study also found that the rising cost of living is having a significant knock-on impact on young people's life goals, as making it through day by day takes priority. The report said having enough money to cover basic needs has become the most common aspiration for most young people, overtaking other traditional goals such as achieving their dream job or buying a house. Only two in four of those surveyed said they believe it is likely they will be able to have enough money to cover basic needs in the future. Shirin Khourihaq, chief executive of Co-op Group, says, "The cost of living has had a seismic impact on young people, with many having to prioritize immediate needs, like where their next meal will come from, over long-term goals and their aspirations." Shirin Khourihaq added, "Remarkably, despite all of this, young people continue to show resilience and ambition to create a better future, but all too often they're cut out of important discussions and policy-making decisions that directly impact them." She added, "We know that taking a grassroots approach and giving young people a voice on the issues which affect them will drive better long-term outcomes for them and their communities." Lynn Perry, chief executive of the charity Barnardo's, said, "We know from our frontline work supporting children and families across the United Kingdom that too many are struggling to access the very basics, including food, and there's an increasing impact on their mental well-being and opportunities. Lynn Perry added, "Worryingly, our new research with Co-op shows that young people seem to be losing hope and do not feel optimistic about their future."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of taqlid, or following a religious scholar, a jurisprudential scholar, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Mm-hmm.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jadeh Hossein, this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. The topic we are discussing with Sheikh Javed in this program, Islamic Laws, in fact, is still the topic of or the concept of taqlid and the questions revolving around this important issue. Sheikh Javed, any individual follow a mujtahid who's not the most learned mujtahid or one when the most learned mujtahid is still alive?
And that's a good question. Well, there's no problem in referring to the mujtahid or following a mujtahid who is not the most learned mujtahid concerning issues in which there's no discrepancy, there's no dispute among the scholars in matters of consensus. Because all the scholars are supposed to have the same fatwa, the same opinion. So if you follow a mujtahid who has the same fatwa as the most learned mujtahid, so you can follow him and it does not make any difference. And in fact, you're following the most learned mujtahid because his fatwa is the same as that of the most qualified mujtahid.
Yes.
So, but in matters where the issues differ, or the scholars differ in their opinions, and there's dispute, there's controversy, there is ambiguity. Of course, it is essential that you follow the most learned of all the scholars.
I see. Would you talk more about this issue? Because I'd like to ask you a question which is quite relevant to this. What is your personal opinion concerning the necessity of following the most learned mujtahid? Is there any proof for this?
You know, if there are, you know, several mujtahids, I mean, actually, I'm speaking on behalf of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, because we are discussing his opinion. So if there are several mujtahids who are qualified for issuing fatwas and their fatwas are different, of course it will be an obligatory precaution. Or the obligatory precaution is for the duty bound for the mukallaf to follow the most learned one, except if it is proven that his fatwa is contrary to precaution, then in that case you can follow the, fatwa or act according to the fatwa of the one who is closer to the precaution. Because when we know the precaution is this or that, then the fatwa which is closer to precaution is a better fatwa, and it is safer, it is more prudent. So in matters of dispute, as I mentioned in one of the previous episodes, is essential that one follow the most qualified scholar, the most qualified mujtahid, because it's safer and more precautionary.
I see. Concerning the taqlid issue, Sheikh Javid, whom should we follow?
It is obligatory to follow a mujtahid who meets all requirements needed for issuing a fatwa and functioning as a marja, as a mujtahid, you know. And according to precaution, he should be the most learned mujtahid, you know. This is the central, the most important characteristic. The most important characteristic is to be the most learned mujtahid. Apart from other, characteristics about from the other traits and qualities that a mujtahid should have, because they are all supposed to be sane, to be just, to be legitimate by birth, to be 12, to be Isna Ashari Shia, and to be adult. Of course, these are the requirements which everyone understands and which everyone accepts as criteria that a mujtahid should meet. But when it comes to being the most qualified in terms of being knowledgeable, then, of course, this is a matter of dispute. And the most of the scholars have said, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, that in matters of dispute, in matters of controversy, in matters of ambiguity and ambiguous matters, the duty-bound person should follow the most learned mujtahid.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. So don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah. Let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad Hossain, this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic is still the issue of taqlid, or following a religious scholar based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to follow a deceased marja? You know, some people, in fact, follow a religious scholar, and it happens that in their own lifetime that they have to either continue to follow the same marja who's passed away, or move on to another marja. So is it permissible to do so? Is it permissible to follow a deceased marja?
Okay. Your question is kind of general, because we see that either we continue to remain in taqlid of a deceased mujtahid, that's one thing, or to initiate taqlid of a living of a deceased mujtahid, a dead mujtahid, that's another issue.
Yes.
Generally speaking, the religious scholars do not allow initiating or beginning to follow a dead mujtahid or a deceased mujtahid. A person who wants to start doing taqlid, like for example, a 15-year-old boy who has hit puberty and who wants to follow a mujtahid, he cannot start following a mujtahid who has passed away.
I see.
Okay, so this is Ayatollah Khamenei says that caution should not be overlooked in following the most learned mujtahid and the living mujtahid when starting to do taqlid of a marja or a mujtahid. So when it comes to, of course, to following a mujtahid, to continuing to follow a mujtahid, then it means that you were following him in the past and you want to continue following him.
Mm.
Of course, you can do so as long as you think, as long as you believe that he is still, he still remains to be the most learned of even the living mujtahids.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He is better knowledgeable than those who are alive, than those scholars who are. You can stay in taqlid of that mujtahid.
I see. Well, I verify the competence of a certain mujtahid as marja through the testimony of two just persons. Is it obligatory for me to ask other people or other persons about this matter also?
You cannot ask the laity to identify the most learned mujtahid. Mm-hmm. Of course, you to ask two jurists.
Right.
To testify or to bear witness that, okay, the certain mujtahid is the most qualified scholar, the most qualified jurist, is one of the ways through which you can identify the most learned mujtahid. Mm. So if there are two people who tell you that a certain mujtahid is the most qualified mujtahid, then you can trust them, provided that two other witnesses do not contradict them.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a contradiction on the part of other two other witnesses, then you cannot follow that mujtahid.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much for joining us, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you.
And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, where we talked about the issues of taqlid based on fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much for listening to us. We wish you farewell. Please keep us in your du'as. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.